the idea has been floating around by Trump and the FHFA.
Yes.
A 50-year mortgage.
Yes.
From your perspective, where is this coming from? And do you see it actually helping people on the ground? Or would it be more of a Band-Aid, even cover-up of deeper structural issues?
Yeah, so I think what this is spaghetti at the wall. Nobody really wants to address the real problem, which is, homes have just become completely unaffordable from a price perspective. It's just spaghetti at a wall. It's what everyone needs to understand, that the housing market is not about Joe and Jane anymore. It's about speculation. It's become a casino. And until we let that speculation rinse through the system, then, it's going to be unaffordable for your first time home buyers.
Welcome back to the show. Steve Yang here. Today, we've got Melody right back with us, the housing market expert who helps us cut through the noise and focus on what really matters. Melody, it's great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Melody, I want to kick things off with what we discussed previously. The idea has been floating around by Trump and the FHFA.
Yes.
A 50-year mortgage.
Yes.
From your perspective, where is this coming from? And do you see it actually helping people on the ground? Or would it be more of a Band-Aid, even cover-up of deeper structural issues?
Yeah, so I think what this is spaghetti at the wall. Nobody really wants to address the real problem, which is, homes have just become completely unaffordable from a price perspective. They became unmoored from household median income, and in a way worse even than the GFC. And so I think, maybe if we trust the news, it was Bill Pulte's idea. I don't even know that I believe that actually, but it's a terrible idea. We already do something called a 40-year modification. So let's say if you had an FHA loan, for instance, which is generally supposed to be for first-time home buyers, and you weren't able to make your payment, then you can extend it out for 40 years. But the problem is people are failing out of that as well, because it doesn't give you that much relief. It just adds on a whole bunch more years, as well as a lot of interest. So for perspective, let me just repeat this so people understand. By year 11, you will have paid $250,000 in interest if, let's say, that home was that loan was a $400,000 loan. Okay, just let that sink in, and you won't even have paid down your balance by 5%. Which means if you have to sell, and the typical life cycle of a mortgage loan is, it's only 7 years. And usually you're either moving or you're refining, and then you're starting all over again. And so it's absolutely bananas. But so the reason why people are failing out of it now too is because property taxes and insurance have gone up so much that when they go to actually do the modification, the payment is higher than their original payment because of those taxes and insurance, which are, in escrow tacked onto that mortgage payment. And so right now, it's a really scary situation out there. There was a recent article from Chicago about homeowners, their taxes doubling. And so that's happened all over the country. And if you're not, and it's especially crushing investors, because if they don't get, there's many states that have a homestead exemption. But yeah, it's a terrible idea. It's just spaghetti at a wall. It's what everyone needs to understand, that the housing market is not about Joe and Jane anymore. It's about speculation. It's become a casino. And until we let that speculation rinse through the system, then, it's going to be unaffordable for your first time home buyers.
When we talk about a 50-year mortgage, it sounds like it's not really going to help. If anything, it's going to keep equity further from being built. What would you say, who would you say are the biggest winners from this? Is it the lenders? There are always winners and losers in this. Is there anyone you see benefiting the most? Is there an alternate motive here from this? Is there, who gets hurt the most? Who benefits the most?
Well, I think the consumer always gets hurt the most, but the lenders don't want this either. That's increasing duration risk. And that's what nobody talked about as well, is that likely for something like this, for the marketplace to consume it, you'd have to have higher interest rates to deal with the risk. And so it's, I don't think there's anywhere. It's just, again, I think it's a way of, you know, saying, okay, we're trying to think of solutions. We want to help you out. But in reality, nobody wins in this, not even the lenders. And so the government, you know, they don't win either, because they have to actually transact in the securitization markets. And so I just think this is, again, it was just something to throw out there for people to talk about and debate about, and in my opinion. And so I don't take it very seriously, and I doubt we're going to actually see it come to fruition. But if it does, no one should use that product. I hope I'm clear.
But like, don't other countries, I don't know what the, and they don't do 50, 40, 50 year old mortgages.
Steve, they don't do 30 year mortgages. We're the only ones. So no one has quite, I went several years ago and studied all these other mortgage markets, and they do 5 to 7 year adjustables. And, you know, some people have tried to do securitization, like India, in their market as well. They haven't been as successful. And no, you may find one other place out there that's doing 30-year, but no, this is very unique. You know, these programs were started during the Great Depression. And that is when the 30-year mortgage actually got started, was as a way to actually, you know, restart the economy during the Depression. And so, No, other countries don't do that. It's usury. In my opinion, there's only one word for it.
So I think it seems to be underlying a deeper issue, that the housing price has just gone way beyond what people can afford. Now, when I was buying homes, I remember the mortgage, they really just asked me, you know, they look for 40%. It's like, you know, up to 40% of the home being your income. Is that still the case today? I mean, are there metrics that are kind of being bent, looked over? I mean, what's the standard now?
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to say, because if you think about the Wizard of Oz, the Fannie and Freddie both have these automated underwriting tools. They're called different things, and they tweak things in the back. And you know, in 2021, they removed the debt-to-income threshold in the Dodd-Frank legislation, like the thing that actually gave it teeth, they removed it. And so the GSEs actually kind of control the buttons in the back. In reality, you should never have, you know, if you go out on any banking website or the FDIC, they only recommend you take out, you know, leverage of, say, like, for your housing costs should not be more than 30% of kind of your take-home pay, right? And some people will say, well, 30% of your top line, whatever. But what's happened, like in the FHA program, it is way higher than that. You can get a loan with up to 57% debt to income, which is crazy. And you can also look at the Fannie Mae debt to income percentage right now on their existing book. We are now at levels seen in 2008. And so they've done a lot of fancy footwork in the background while doing a lot of credit quality gospel singing. But in reality, the lenders have learned how to kind of game AUS and how to, you know, work it to get somebody approved. And I'm seeing things in servicing, which is the other side of origination. Like that's where you always see the big hairy warts. And I can tell you that I'm seeing things that are even worse than what I saw. And I said this to you guys on that show. Oh. And it's just things that people with a mortgage that said they got divorced and somehow, but they're still in the know, but somehow they still got another loan. Like, it's all these tried and true things that anybody who is truly doing underwriting would never do. And so we've gotten over our skis again. And on top of this, you know, this is what so many people don't understand, is there's so much fraud. Like, the Philly Fed came out with a paper in 2023 and said, listen, you know, fraud in real estate didn't stop after the GFC. And in fact, when you have investor participation, expect 30% of that to be fraud. And so if you think that, you know, our percentage of investor participation is around 30%, then, you know, kind of do the math of that. And what's happening is you have these Airbnb bros selling homes back and forth to one another so they can at ridiculous prices that don't match reality. And I've seen this in crazy examples of this. So they can turn around and go get a refinance and buy another home. But that refinance is based on a price that was never real in the first place because they're selling it back and forth to one another. And so they can set a comp. And so I think what we're about to see is just the massive wave of fraud in real estate. And it always takes time to flush through the system. I'm seeing signs of it already. But yeah, I think people are going to be shocked by how much fraud is in the system right now.
So when you say 2008, I'm sure if other people are like me listening, that should be a thing that takes your breath a bit, maybe sets off a little bit of a panic, makes you wonder how to brace for impact. Why are people not hearing the alarms bell ringing? Or is the alarm just being just kind of ignored? Do people just not see? I mean, what are you seeing that's like evidence that this is 2008 numbers, or it's got that sort of catastrophic potential?
Yeah, so mainstream has just done its level best to hide this. I mean, the narrative machine has just been unbelievable to watch. You know, one of the things I did in 2023, I woke up to an article in Bloomberg where they said the housing market was turning around, and I was like, you're insane. And so I got out on the road to prove what I, you know, my thesis that there wasn't an inventory shortage. Now, listen, is there an affordable inventory shortage? 100%, but we don't have a shortage of homes. And anybody that looks at our demographics would understand that. But instead, they just look at what's been built before. You know, we didn't build exactly the same. It's like, no, it's a different, you know. And in reality, we also now know that the only population gain we had last year was foreign born. And so, you know, and if that stops, which we know it is, then we're not going to have population growth. And we already, you know, average household size is at 2.5, which means that we have plenty of housing stock out there. And that doesn't, you know, like, because we built in the multifamily, we went crazy with that as well. And so it's narrative. And honestly, it's, you know, for me, even when I knew that housing was going to have a problem, at first I didn't think mortgage was going to be an issue because I worked so hard to make sure this would never happen again in mortgage. But then as you started to peel back the onion, you were like, oh my gosh, this is all happening again. And in fact, the government just took the place of the private sector last time. So you had private subprime last time. Now we have government-backed subprime at scale. So FHA is twice what it was during that previous cycle. And so I'm not trying to, you know, scare everybody, but I want everyone to understand that these prices just don't match reality. There's two articles today, Steve, saying exactly that. One in Bloomberg and one in the Wall Street Journal. And I got to tell you, it's just like once you really just watch the media for narrative, it is hilarious how in concert these things actually happen. And so, you know, 2 weeks ago, we got articles in both about the builders and the trouble that the builders are in. Now, Bloomberg sounded more like a marketing campaign, but they both are signaling that the builders are in serious trouble. And so it's like, finally, it's as if mainstream media has said, okay, we can start to talk about this after 3 years of frozen housing market. And so it's just, I think that people, it's this weird thing that you don't even believe your own eyes, or you think that somehow your situation is unique. And what they're saying in the media must be right, because, you know, maybe you're the idiot that bought and has buyer's remorse. And so you're not like everybody else out there. And I think that's what the media has done. It's a real injustice because it led really young, borrowers into situations that's going to, you know, follow them around for several years and impair their credit and ability to get credit.
So, I mean, you're seeing certain things that are very alarming. I would suspect, when, like we're saying, the, you know, like 2008, when you're making money, you're enjoying things, you're having fun, you're printing stuff, and great. And you want to be on the bull, but aren't lenders, shouldn't they be more concerned about, you know, fraud and not look the other way? I mean, are they seeing stuff? Or, I mean, where's the whole, what sounds like looking the other way or just happy obliviousness coming from?
Well, it's the agencies. So it's like a game. You submit all these financials to this automated underwriting tool and it says approved. And everybody thinks, okay, so if the agencies are going to buy it, then I'm money good. Because most of them haven't been through a huge cycle like this where they don't understand what happens is that when that default starts ticking up, the agencies turn around and make you repurchase that loan. Yeah. And so most of the big non-bank players right now didn't have big books during the crisis. And what I can tell you coming from a top five originator and servicer is that my understanding of the crisis was very different than mm-hmm. when I left there and went to other non-banks. And I would try to tell them, this is what you have to do. And they just couldn't get it because it, you know, they hadn't gone through it. And so now what you have, these Rocket, United Wholesale, these big non-banks, mm-hmm. they did not have government loans at scale like during the last crisis. So they don't know what they're in for. And so they don't have a ton of agency, these non-bank lenders. And they're just following the music of the machine. If the machine says it's approved, then that's all they look at. And it sells along through. And that's all fine and good while the party's still going.
Right.
But it's the minute that the party starts to stop, that's when you, and it's, I mean, it's trite, but true. That's when you see who's swimming naked, right? And so these non-banks are in for some serious trouble, really serious trouble. In fact, many of them probably won't survive because they don't understand, too. They think those FHA loans are fully government-backed, but I used to manage a claims department, which is as boring as it sounds. and we never got a full claim back. I mean, there's just, you can't the way that the rules have been set up. And so, yeah, it's really here. The biggest actor, in my opinion, are the GSEs and FHA. So our, you know, government sponsored enterprises and our fully, you know, government backed FHA.
Speaking of government, my understanding of kind of what not bailed us out, but what kind of, it took a long time bailing us out, but like there was a government had to intervene and they had to step in. From what it sounded like last time, we might be in a different position. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, in reality, and nobody wants to hear this, what saved home prices from actually crashing all the way to where they really should have gone, matching household median income again, was Wall Street coming in at the invitation of government to buy these foreclosed homes, which they did. They bought them up, and I was at those auctions. I saw it happen, and then they did long-term rental. I've got to go find this clip and who it was, but one of these big institutionals was doing an interview where you can already see they're going to start their crying. And he's like, you know, they wanted us to buy these homes, but now what's happened is those institutionals can't make any money because they can't get cheap borrowing anymore. And their property taxes and insurance have skyrocketed. Plus you've got vacancy increasing with all this new supply for multifamily when you can get 3 months for free. A nice luxury 3-bedroom. Why would you, you know, go do that single family rental if you don't have a dog or whatever? I mean, there's so much competition out there. So they are net selling right now. For like a year or so, they were selling to each other, but now they are offloading into the market in places like Atlanta, which is why you're seeing year over year price declines there. And so you asked about government specifically. We don't have a buyer this time. We don't have because, you know, now, of course, could they try something like, okay, we'll give you some, like they did with SVB, right? You know, we'll give you 100 cents on the dollar for your crappy asset or something like that. But that still won't work because of property taxes and insurance. And so I think that actually And you know, so far what they've passed is a lot of like, okay, we're going to give you assistance at a certain percent of adjusted gross income, that kind of thing. But I have a feeling they might get in the business of buying back these homes. And, you know, like right now, I think, was it the Flagstar portfolio? There's a lot of rent stabilized homes on that were bought up in that situation. Yeah. The government's holding. So anyway, that might be what they do. We shall see. Because these municipalities aren't going to be able to handle this crisis.
So, as I've always believed in real estate, but you know, just the whole thing about doing it smart. And I also have seen how I used to have several Airbnb properties. I've recently gotten rid of. After last time I spoke with you, I looked at Andy. I'm going, maybe I did the right thing here.
Oh yeah.
And so these Airbnbs, you know, like. There's, you know, we talk about real estate as being assets. I know that, you know, they can be assets and they can quickly become liabilities. And that's when right. I hear you saying that there's going to be an issue with Airbnbs or there's going to be a plethora just of empty buildings or something, is just like, can you talk a little bit about just the danger of, because I remember reading books on real estate, and when I hear you talking about refinancing and getting the HELOCs to get more properties and like what kind of danger are you potentially anticipating where these can quickly turn to liabilities?
Yeah, so I think they have for a lot of people. You know, it's all over social media. Where and so, you know, but it's very what you're saying, we've got a travel slowdown, right? Vegas is a great example. I mean, they are getting hit very hard. And of course, all these seniors down there bought homes to be short-term rental, and they're not getting the occupancy they need. And so quickly, because a lot of these Airbnb folks walked into a private lender, and that private lender said, why buy one, buy 10 instead. And so very quickly, if you can't refi, then mm-hmm. you're going to be in a serious situation, because it's just like the scene in The Big Short. It's so crazy. We didn't learn a single thing, but it's like they thought they could always refi, right? And so, you know, we just saw the Fed came out with its summary of consumer expectations, and we just saw the highest rejection rate for mortgage refinances that we have ever seen in that series, which started in 2013. And this was the second high. The first one was in February. And so these Airbnb bros are like, they are underwater. They are not cash flowing. They are in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, real estate is a appreciating asset. Like a house is a depreciating asset. It's going to need constant maintenance and care. It's the land, you know, and if you can't, you know, if you can't fill your mini hotel, and by the way, you know, in San Diego, where they have over 12,000 Airbnbs, they also have plenty of hotels. And so, you know, and then you ask danger. To me, what I've seen all over the country is vacancy, and vacancy of commercial real estate, vacancy of homes, people who bought these, like bought a home to do a fix and flip and then ran out of money. And so it's, I mean, this is going to be community blight. It's going to be a big issue for these municipalities to have to deal with this. And so very quickly, at the same time that you can't refi, we're going to start to see home price depreciation. And it just, I mean, it just cascades from there.
So let's move from investors to first-time home buyers who are looking for their first home. I mean, my understanding is that the age of average home buyers has increased significantly. But first of all, if you can talk about who these first-time home buyers are and how they're approaching the market, maybe differently compared to previous years.
I feel like so many of them have given up. Like, it's just they've given up. And you know, unfortunately with that, what the ones that didn't give up and they got in around 21, 22, 23, even 24, which I can't believe, they were enticed by these low down payment, you know, programs like FHA, where you only have to put 3.5% down, but also you could go get down payment assistance as well to cover that 3.5%. But so what happens in that situation is they buy an overpriced home, which continues to have, you know, continues to let homes inflate, while at the same time they've paid for something they can't afford. And so they quickly get underwater and get into trouble. And so that's what's happening to a lot of those first time home buyers. But most of the ones that want to buy that I talk to, they're sitting, they're waiting, you know, because they just know that this is absolutely unsustainable. But yeah, that I think the median age of homeowners right now is 59 years old.
Wow.
It's insane. I mean, it's insane. And so, you know, if what I would say to first time home buyers is this isn't the moment. You know, we need more sales to get true price discovery. But here's what just happened and what everybody needs to know is with those two articles in the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg, the boomers just got a message, right? They got a message that your home is probably not worth what you think it is. If they read the Wall Street Journal article, they got the message that, hey, instead of doing a price cut, you should just list it more realistically by looking at comparables in your neighborhood. Otherwise, you know, you don't look as enticing if you've had like 7 price cuts.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Bloomberg one is essentially the story of a bunch of people delisted because they were so mad about not getting the price they want. And that's just silly. That's the Bloomberg story. So your boomers just got a message. And so this is where, if I'm a first-time home buyer, I give ridiculously low offers. I look at those listings that have been sitting out there forever, you know, but if you're even it, that still for that message to get received, it's going to take some time. And what's on their side is that this FHA program that I've been talking about, they also had this crazy loss mitigation where you could just keep going back over and over and over again to get your payments put at the back of the loan. So there's so many people that are underwater now. Those folks, that program just got capped and additional guardrails were put on it. And so by Q1 of 2026, we're going to start to see people failing out of FHA at a higher rate. And then by Q2 2026, which is going to be kind of at the culmination of the selling season, you're going to have material foreclosures. You already have them all over the country. In every market I track, 85, they're right there. 85 markets. So what'll happen is those two things, you're going to have the selling season where people are like, I need to sell, and you're going to have foreclosures increase. And so I think that is when we're really going to have a real down, like, it, you know, the downturn will start to really be out there, not just in, you know, Zillow just came out and said, well, 53% of homes had price value decline of the average 9.6%. Well, that's in the Zestimate, right? That's not, you know, we need the sales for that to happen. But yeah, if I'm a first-time home buyer, firstly, you know, what I say to people is please don't participate in the FOMO. I mean, you will get in over your head so quickly. And just be prudent, like actually save your money. Just, you know, try to make, I don't want to be one of those people that says, if you didn't get Starbucks, you wouldn't, you know, but I will say Starbucks every day is one full mortgage payment in a year, you know? So it just make a little different choices. Don't fall for the FOMO. And you asked before the show, and we talked about in the last show about like, how do you really know what a price is, what a home is worth? And so there's a tool called Property Radar. They don't sponsor me. But I really am a fan of the tool. It's subscription based, but it's pricey, but not too pricey if you just do it for a couple of months. Because what I want people to do is really investigate where they think they want to live. You know, it's not just about schools. It's not just, you know, you really want to understand who's in your neighborhood. Is it, you know, are they renters? Are they owners? Is there a lot of institutional ownership in your neighborhood? Because that means you're going to see price declines because they don't care. They're just going to sell them. Are you in a new build? Okay, wait, is this new build fully, you know, fully sold out? Because a lot of times they pretend like it is, but it's really not. And then when they can't, they go sell to somebody like American Homes for Rent. To do rental, and you thought you were going to be surrounded by homeowners. But Property Radar will tell you what's actually going on under the covers. You'll be able to see tax liens, owner liens, things like that, foreclosures. And you'll also have comps, like real comps, not Zillow 20 miles away comps, like actual comps of things that just sold in those neighborhoods. So you can really do your own analysis. Of what's going on. And but get to go to the neighborhood, go to the cleaners, go to the coffee shop, talk to people. Because what many people don't realize too, is like, okay, that looks like a great neighborhood, but do you really want it to take you 20 minutes to get out of your neighborhood to get to your school? I mean, is that what you want it to be like? So I just feel like we've let these technology programs think for us, like Zillow and others telling us what we should be looking for in a home. It's just not that easy. It's really not. You know, you really have to do your homework. But I think opportunity is coming.
So yeah, we talked about Zestimate is the only thing that most people know. That's the only thing I knew. Right. So Property Radar gives you more accurate things you can look at. For a buyer or seller, though, it's like other people are still looking at Zestimate.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what words of advice do you have to give for both a buyer and a seller in terms of like, how they approach negotiations?
Yeah. If I'm a seller, you know, I think it is a good idea to be more realistic on that listing price. You know, just and also what they're not doing is taking into consideration all of the repairs that are needed. And so, you know, if I'm thinking about listing my house, I would go get a real appraisal. And it's pricey. And some people would say it's not necessary because they would get it through the, you know, like the buyer would do one, things like that. But to me, I'd really want to know what a real certified appraiser thinks this house is worth with all the things that likely need to be fixed and things like that.
Yeah.
And if I'm a buyer, I have to be very cautious and I have to be ready to be disappointed because here's the thing, like my favorite story from last spring was somebody in LA who told me they would never be able to afford a home out there. They'd never be able to buy one, blah, 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 blah. I mean, just on and on. And then I just kept watching the inventory rise. And I finally just said, hey, listen, are you serious? Like you can't find. And they said, oh no. Yeah. Like I was so bummed out because there was an all cash. I did an offer on this home. There was an all cash offer that beat me, but then they called me back like, and they begged me to take this house because it needed some repair in the foundation.
Yeah.
And you know, they got independent appraisals, like a couple different opinions. But so, you know, you may feel like an idiot at first. They may laugh at you, but at some point, like they won't be laughing anymore and they'll be begging you. And it's just going to take, you know, being able to stay steadfast and not because buying a home is very emotional. People get very emotional about it. And I would just say, don't be emotional. Be realistic. That sounds simple, but
no, that's good words of the wisdom there. So you were talking about fraud and stuff that's not accurate. I mean, people, you know, we hear so many different voices in the housing conversation. It's hard to know what's actually true. What's a common take you hear that makes you think, no, that's not quite right? Is there something that stands out as like where we're really misinformed?
Yes, so many places. But you know, Housing Wire, that they ran my initial article about debunking the inventory myth, but you know, their main analyst, who used to be a loan officer, talks about the fact that people will be able to afford homes because of dual incomes. We've had dual income since the 70s. And honestly, I don't know if you know Michael Green, but he just did an amazing piece on Substack that really questions the way that the poverty line has been calculated. It was done back, I think, in the 60s based on food cost. And in reality, he makes an argument that really the new poverty line is around 140,000 or 100,000, somewhere around there, because of just housing costs, insurance, childcare, things like that. So he talks too as well about we've had dual incomes for like ever. You know, that's one of the reasons why home prices started to rise. They tracked like this until that started. And then, of course, all of the using housing to really juice the economy started. I think that this issue is, there's so many people out there as well wedded to the inventory shortage narrative. Like, so another big person who writes about housing and was known, at least his group was known because he had a different analyst for calling the last crisis. Mm-hmm. These guys all seem to be missing demographics. I think that's the biggest piece of it. And I'll never forget when you tell people, okay, so we know the boomers own the most homes. We know there's 15 million vacant properties, the census tells us, and that's not abandoned.
Yeah.
We have additional 3 million that are seasonal properties. And then we have, you know, and probably like the 2 million that people say we have in Airbnb are kind of probably part of that. So we have plenty of housing stuck, and the boomers are going to start this. People always get mad when I say this, but it's like it's inevitable. They're going to be leaving us. Harvard says, you know, 15.6 million by 2035. And so this silver tsunami, people just aren't thinking about it. Like they just think, they also look at, Harvard also did a great study on household formation. And we pulled forward so much household formation in COVID, you know, not because of those stimmy checks, but because of the PPP and the ERC and the EIDL loans. Like, you know, parents help their kids get into homes. That's petered out. That's the other story you'll hear. It's like, we have all these millennials that need to form they can't afford it. So
So speaking of demographics, boomers, they're going to leave their homes. And I know that certain parts, my guess is that retirement areas like such as Florida is going to have quite the impact. Are there parts of the U.S. that's going to get hit more severely than others that it's like, that are more susceptible to what we're talking about here?
Yeah. You know, the Northeast has a real demographics problem, you know, and I think that you're going to see this, you'll often see the argument that, well, there's not that much building in the Northeast, so they'll be fine. But no, they have the demographics problem, and they've had people leaving for years and years, and it's just going to continue. But yes, Florida, I mean, for heaven's sake, I've driven that state up and down, east to west. It is so terrifying what happened there. It's terrifying because when I managed default, I spent most of 2012 in Florida. And I went to neighborhoods, you know, neighborhoods that even got razed, like they got bulldozed, and that's where they built again. And it's you can read books like Bubble in the Sun or Swamp Peddlers. And this has been going on, you know, for 100 years, if not longer, with Florida. And they always lead the cycle. And then Texas, but honestly, Steve, all over the country. I mean, even like places like Riverside, California, they have just built, like from San Antonio to Austin is one big new build site. I mean, it is just so terrifying. I've captured drone footage, all of this stuff, but you can't really understand the scale until you go out there on the road. I mean, they've just built them in cow pastures, you know, next to feedlots, next to train. I mean, all this stuff is going to have to be bulldozed, a lot of it.
Yeah, a lot of scary stuff out there.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's like, that's the thing with the headlines. I'm so appreciate you being here because we don't hear all this stuff in the headlines. And, you know, we get other data that doesn't matter. And so, you know, when it comes to like data behind the headlines, not all the data is created equal. Could you,
no.
I guess my last question I have for you is if you can help us cut through the noise, and are there key metrics, key statistics that you're keeping a close eye on over the next 6-12 months, the things that really matter as opposed to things that media is asking us to look at?
Yeah, well, layoffs matter a lot. And I think, you know, what we're starting, I mean, it's just getting really depressing now because you're seeing big layoffs in like small towns where that's the primary employer. So layoffs matter a whole bunch. And so, you know, watching those, the defaults matter. Don't listen to the industry Black Knight ICE who puts out the default report. You want to look at, here's the thing. You can't look at just one thing. That's what's so upsetting because they're all missing something. Like even the Fed uses Experian for its household debt and credit schedule. And what I can tell in Experian is that you've got a lot of your servicers not reporting to them. And so we do not. And here's just a quick crazy thing that Fannie and Freddie, the way you worked out those forbearances was through a payment deferral, which they did not record on county records. So you have second liens out there that nobody's talking about. Okay. Everybody's going to wake up and be like, what? Like nobody saw this coming because it is so, the data just masks. Like, and also you'll look at the Fed does a delinquency schedule for mortgage. Well, the problem is, it's just the banks. And the banks only have pristine paper. It's the non-banks that have been doing the majority of the lending. So you can look at things like delinquency from the Fed. Look at, they do that, this credit, household debt and credit. You're going to start to see that rise. You know, for ATOM, ATTOM tracks foreclosures. They do a report every month. So you have to kind of triangulate. But the fact that we're seeing so many layoffs, we're going to start seeing the prime borrowers be impacted. And so that's when you know we're deep in the cycle. Like your FHA always leads because it is lower credit quality. But yeah, that's what you really should be watching. Because I've now realized, Steve, that I feel like kind of an idiot sometimes when I realize that NAR is really fudging their numbers. And, you know, it's a model. I've now caught it several times. And then, you know, the new home data, the builders fill that out. And by the way, finally, we've got people talking about what they've been doing because they've been doing those buy downs and incentives. There's supposed to be a cap on that, but they've been getting around it and sidestepping it. And so there was a big article about that. I think that's going to come to a head. But NAR does not have your best interests at heart, National Association of Realtors. They're the ones that publish existing home sales and price.
No.
Just understand that that's a model, and it's not based on reality. And they were caught in the last cycle and had to restate 3 years of home prices. And I thought, well, surely because they were caught last time, they won't do it this time.
Who's keeping an eye on things? Who's keeping people in check?
No, nobody. Nobody is. Because it's just too much fun. It's too much fun. All of our homes are worth millions of dollars. Right. It's fun until you get that property tax assessment. It's fun until your insurance is like, oh, you think it's worth $3 million? Okay, well, then you're going to have to pay a lot more to replace it. So, you know, the party was just too fun. They just, it's crazy. It's actually crazy. But
Melody, if you can talk a little bit about your Substack, where people can find you, learn about, you know, like you seem to be one of the voices that I would want to listen to, you know, to help triangulate what really matters. If you can share a little bit more about information on how people can find you.
Yeah, absolutely. So my Substack is M3 Melody Substack. And I encourage, this is a passion for me and wanting to save people who got so hurt, like from what happened last time. The free version always lays out the arguments and the tools, so you can do this yourself. So I'd encourage people to sign up. That's M3 Melody Substack. And then you can find me on X Twitter at M3_Melody and on YouTube at M3 Melody.
Melody, thanks so much for giving us the truth. Yeah. It's like
as unpleasant as it is. Yeah.
But it's like, we need to hear it. We need to hear it. And I appreciate the privilege of bringing you back on and getting to ask more questions that I had. And I'm hoping and hopeful that it'll help a lot of people. So
cool.
Thank you so much, Melody.
Thank you for having me.
All right.